Dave Malarkey, and It's Your Turn will be coming up next.
And now, It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's Your Turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's Your Turn, 724-283-2525. And now, It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey.
Well, hello there. Good afternoon. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Wednesday edition of It's Your Turn. We've made it to the middle of the week, over the hump day, and no injuries so far. So what a crazy week it's been weather-wise, especially with temperature. You know, yesterday we were in the mid-50s early on. Day before yesterday was in the low 60s. I got to work this morning a little after 5 a.m. It was 28. So quite a remarkable change. And as you heard, it's going to warm back up again tomorrow after a chilly day today. So real roller coaster ride temperature-wise. This is the kind of thing we would ordinarily see maybe in late March. You know, this sort of weather where we're up and down like a roller coaster. A little bit early this year. Hey, we're going to talk about the mild winter and what effect it might have on area farmers. We're pleased to welcome on the first portion of the program today from Penn State Extension, agronomy educator Justin Brackenridge. Justin, good to see you again. Nice to have you back with us.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me.
So I just saw a wire story on this. I think it was Monday. It might have been over the weekend. I'm not sure. Because we're not alone in having a very, very minimal snowfall this year in western Pennsylvania. Much of the Northeast, not everywhere, but much of the Northeast in the Ohio Valley has just not had hardly any snow at all. That snow we had was it Sunday that we had the 2 or 3 inches of snow that was gone by noon? That was one of the biggest snowfalls we've had all year. So the question in this wire story was, will the lack of snow be a help to farmers or a hindrance? Ordinarily, if you don't get a whole lot of snow, then there's not enough snow melt come spring for the necessary moisture. So that would be a bad thing. On the other hand, we haven't had a lot of snow. We've had a lot of rain. So the groundwater is, you know, it's pretty good. We're still pretty saturated. So probably won't have too much of effect on farmers, the lack of snow this winter.
So, you know, there's a couple things to unpack about that. And generally what we think of first of snow is with our perennial forages, right? So the things that we would plant and we would go to over and over through the year. Mm-hmm. The snowfall is actually a very good insulator of heat. And so when we think of things like our grasses that we would use for pasture or hay or alfalfa, when we have snowfall, that really helps to protect those plants through the winter when we have a lot of cold weather so that their survivability is better in the spring. Huh. We also think of that with our small grains like wheat or barley or something along those lines. And so when we have a really cold winter with snowfall, that helps that survivability. And so this year, as you've mentioned, we haven't been extremely cold. And so that lack of snowfall, you know, we don't see that as being a huge problem there. The other kind of side of this is when we get really cold, that can help reduce some of our insect pressures and some of our disease pressures. You know, later I want to talk a little bit more about the insects and the diseases, but that's becoming a lot bigger problem for us as we continue to look at these really wet, really kind of cool and overcast springs. This is just kind of so from an agronomy standpoint or something like that, it's really kind of fascinating to look at all of the different kind of diseases and fungal infections that we find. But from a farming and a producing standpoint, it's not nearly as fascinating to see all these infections that you're seeing.
Yeah.
But one of the good things of having no snow and very cold is that you can kill insects and you can kill diseases. And so it's kind of a double-edged sword, right? We aren't getting cold. We're not seeing the snow. And so we may, in fact, in the spring, see more insect pressures and more diseases than what we've seen in the last couple years.
And, of course, with you being a Penn State Extension agronomy educator, you're looking at this from a scientific basis. Most of us, you know, will just look at the last 2 years. Not only spring, but summers, very wet. I mean, it just seemed like it rained every other day, and it was just so soggy everywhere. But, you know, we're just saying that's what it seemed like, you know. Hey, it's rained a lot the last couple of springs and summers. You're having more of a scientific approach. I mean, you're examining what effect this has had and may have on farmers.
Right, and so I was talking, I had a crops day yesterday in Indiana County, and I was talking to one of our plant pathologists out there, so someone that studies these fungi that are getting on these, and from where we sit, you know, he said it was the Powerball winner was an ear of corn that had four different fungal infections at the same time. So from us, from the scientific side, that's just, you know, like the holy grail, right? To be able to dissect these and see penicillin and anthracnose and all of these different diseases. But like you said, to the farmer, they're like, no, that's not fun, right? So we get out and we're really excited. But we've always kind of had this mentality as a producer and a farmer that, you know, April's here, it's May, we really need to get going. And the same with some of our home gardeners, right? We've been cooped up, and especially up here, you know, we kind of get shut in. And so when the springtime comes, we really get ready to go, right? As soon as it warms up, we're like, let's start planting, let's start digging in the dirt.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening is we're putting our seeds out, and we're getting them out of the ground. But if you can think back to last year, we really didn't see a lot of sunshine until the end of May or 1st of June,
true,
right? It was really kind of hazy and overcast a lot of the time. And so we see corn and we see beans and we see our crops, and they pop up to about 4 or 5 inches. And that just lets them sit there really, really exposed to these insects and these diseases. And so we need them to be – we're getting to a point, and so the industry is agreeing – the data from the universities are agreeing that maybe now what we're not really supposed to be doing is planting so early, but we're supposed to be planting when the weather is right, when we're warming up and when our soils are warm at that 55 degree to that 60 degree weather, and that's going to warm up our soils so that when we plant, we're going to grow. You know, we're not going to get to that point and just kind of lay stagnant.
Mm-hmm.
And we can avoid some of this hardship that we're having in early growth. And then, in turn, kind of alleviate some of these pressures of replants and spraying fungicides and spraying insecticides and maybe sleeping a little bit better at night instead of worrying about all these insects and diseases.
That makes sense to me. I'm not a farmer. I didn't grow up on a farm. But it makes sense, and it occurs to me that this might well apply to backyard gardeners too. Not necessarily people are growing, you know, vegetables for sale, but just, you know, backyard gardeners, instead of going by the calendar, you know, well, it's the end of April or it's May 10th or whatever your traditional date was. Wait until you get the proper soil temperature, even if that's a little later than usual, because that's going to ensure a better harvest.
Right, and that's what we're seeing, right? So we use a term called growing degree days. And so, you know, me along with a lot of us, we have smartphones now. We can get on the internet, and there's apps. And this growing degree day, what it does is there's a formula, but simplified, what that's looking at is your daytime temperature compared to your nighttime temperature,
mm-hmm,
accumulated over the day. And we're really targeting those growing degree days is to where the plant can thrive. Once we're below 50 degrees during the day and 30 degrees at night, we're not going to see the plants thrive. They're going to just kind of hang out. But we want to grow so that we can be competitive. And that's what we're looking for. And so we're encouraging people to really take advantage of the technology that we have of mapping growing degree days, you know, seeing that we're up there. One of the really early ones is a forsythia, right? So that really pretty yellow bush, that's going to bloom at about 325 growing degree days. And that's a really good indicator that's when you're going to start getting into some peak growing days. That means we're really making it to that point where that's a good time that your soil should be warming. And from here on out, you're going to see a little bit better weather, and that's when you should be targeting growth.
Mm. I never heard that term, growing degree days, before. You mentioned it here a couple of minutes ago. That's new to me. Growing degree days, huh? My dad used to say, my dad was a great, he loved sweet corn, and he planted a ton of it in the backyard garden. He would always say that when he got to the really hot, not only the hot days, but the warm nights, the hot nights of July and August, he said, you can hear the corn growing over, you can hear it growing overnight. We used to laugh at him, but probably true.
And that's it. You know, it's not just the days, but it's the nights that we see in the spring. We still get a lot of cool nights. And so that's what we're asking people is to pay attention to your nights as well as your days.
Well, here we are talking about planting and harvesting, and it's not really time for that yet. In fact, this is the time of the year, specifically for you as a Penn State agronomy educator. You're trying to schedule meetings now because it's a little bit of a downtime for a lot of farmers, right?
Yeah, so right now, you know, we call this our spring kind of a rush. Most of our farmers are kind of in this point where we're kind of a hurry up and wait mentality because we're all ready to go plant. But this is when we take advantage of most of our educational time. We're pushing a lot of meetings from the Penn State side, but we're partnering with a lot of industry meetings. Excuse me. We've had some already, and I really am very, very thankful for all of the folks that have come out and they've joined us at these meetings. We've had really great success so far. It has been truly my pleasure to be here for the last couple of years with Butler County and build this program. You know, we started and we didn't have an agronomist here. And just in the last couple of years, it's been really fantastic to watch how much we have grown. So it's just really wonderful that the community has accepted me and my programming so well. And it's very encouraging as we continue meetings. And so that's one of the fun things that I get to do is talk to producers and talk to farmers at these meetings and find out what they want. And so that's what we've done this year is because I've been able to meet most of my goals because they've come out so well, I can add new meetings and feel that we can do that. So traditionally, we always have our pesticide updates this year. So if you're a pesticide user and you're using any registered pesticides, you're carrying a license through Pennsylvania Department of Ag that you have to keep training up for. So every 3 years, you have to keep a certain amount of educational credits. Those licenses expire, and they expire March 31st if you need those credits. And so we do a lot of that over February and over March.
This is because they need to be recertified because of the danger of pesticide abuse, and it can be dangerous stuff if it's not used and applied properly.
Right. So there is the dangers to the environment. There's the dangers to the people that aren't using it themselves. But we also have the dangers that we're seeing a lot that we want to avoid in our area of creating these weeds that are now resistant to pesticides, right? I mean, that's a huge issue that we see in agriculture of these ALS, which is a mode of action that we use to target things. We want to educate our producers on how to avoid these types of resistant weeds.
I never thought of that, but this is analogous then to, because we've seen a lot of stories in recent years about the dangers of immediately taking penicillin and other drugs for what might be just a minor ailment because the viruses they're developing a resistance to this. So if you get really sick, then these drugs won't work anymore. So the same thing applies to weeds.
Absolutely the same.
Wow.
And we see this when we use a product and we don't want to use the right amount, and so we use too little, or we also use too much, right? So the old adage, if a little's good, a lot's better, right? So we really try to avoid using things like that. But we want to educate people, right? So we're not using the same product. As you mentioned, penicillin. You know, maybe we switch to a different type of medication to get rid of this. So we're asking people, you know, come spend some time with us. Let's talk about these different options that we have. And we also want to educate them on what the best thing is for them, right? So agriculture is a very important industry to Pennsylvania, and there's constantly new varieties coming out of management changes that they can do with corn and with beans. And so this is a great time to talk to us, to talk to their neighbors, to do – it's as much socializing because I learned so much from them. They learn stuff from each other's of what do and don't work. And so we really have a good time to visit and then learn some stuff along the way. And ag literacy is really important for us now to share this information and all be well-trained on what we're doing out there.
You also have a forage workshop. In fact, that's coming up very soon, is it not?
Yes. Yeah, so February 18th, we're going to do a forage workshop. We did a hay workshop a couple years ago, last year, maybe the year before, and it was really well attended. So we felt like that was something we should bring back. And I'm going to work on this with USDA. We're going to do a half-a-day thing. It's $5 to attend, and that's going to cover a lunch, right? So we're going to get pizza or something like that and just do a really simple kind of a lunch. And what we're going to do is we're really just going to start at the beginning of how we can soil test to know what our nutrient levels are in our field. And then we're going to talk about our grass species that we're using, how we can diversify, how we can, kind of amplify our production. And then we're going to get more specific to forages, specifically to pasture. What can we do to better our pasture if we're feeding sheep or horses or beef cattle or dairy? How can we really hone in and focus on better management? And then we'll talk about hay. This is going to be, again, so forages are my background. This is kind of my one for the year I'm looking forward to. So I want this to be very relaxed. I want this to be something that we can talk about. And I just want people to leave there saying, we learned something, right? I just want to bring out a couple things that can really make some huge management changes that are very minute of lifting a mower up a half an inch or rotating your livestock or something very simple that can be very big profit boosters in your operation.
And forage, for those who aren't familiar with the term, that's crops that are generally used for feed. Am I correct on that?
Right. So what we'll focus on will be grass forages and alfalfa. So we'll target mostly on pasture and hay. But forages can also encompass some of our grains. So if we're looking at corn silage or sorghum or sedan or anything like that, that could go into an animal feed, forage is just, kind of a generic term, like you said, for anything we're going to use to feed livestock.
Are there diseases for these crops that spread and change as well?
Yeah. So, again, we talked a lot about disease earlier. I'm very passionate about forages and livestock, but our forage producers that I work with, and I'm trying to not throw my forage friends under the bus, but they don't really scout their forages, right? So when we talk about scouting, that's getting out in the field and looking to see what insects are out there and what diseases are out there. And forage producers are not really good at doing that. Not that they're not good, but they don't like to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're seeing a lot of diseases happening in forages as well as our row crops and our corn and our beans and things. And so I want to talk a little bit more about that with them. So we've touched on the forages, on diseases. But one thing I do want to bring up is that Penn State has a forage disease lab, just a plant disease lab. And this is open to agricultural producers. It's open to home gardeners, your flower beds, your trees, apple trees, anything you have. And it's a free service to Pennsylvania residents.
Is it located at University Park?
Yep. But if you bring it to the Butler office, we ship it for free. We have a very simple form that you fill out, and we take your information, but it's basically only just so we know if there starts to be an outbreak of frog eye leaf spot in apple trees, we can start to warn other apple producers in the area, hey, start scouting for this. It's not to, haha, you have this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really encouraging people to take advantage of this free service, because when we build these services into budgets and things, if we don't take advantage, if we can't report back that, hey, we did this much, then they get cut out of budgets. Other states, they'll charge between $20 and $50 to get something like this done. And we get a lot of people that say, I wonder what this is. Easy, bring it into the extension office, fill out a sheet of paper, and we'll mail it for you. And then you know, 10 days, you're going to have an answer of what it is.
Can you do this with flowers, too?
Absolutely. You can do this with any, you know, any plant specimen you have. What we ask is that you bring it in alive. You know, don't wait for it to be dead, because then we'll see secondary infections and secondary diseases.
Mm-hmm.
Don't take it on a Friday and throw it up on the dash of the truck and let it sit for the weekend. You know, we ask that you bring it in like a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, so that when we ship it, it can be received in the lab and not lay in the mail over the weekend. And if you're worried about sample size, bring a bunch, and we'll make the decision on how much we need to send. We can help you pack it. But again, you know, it's a really neat thing that Penn State does. And, you know, it's analytical data, right? You've got someone with a microscope, with a PhD, that's really very good at this, rather than me with a microscope trying to make assumptions of what's wrong with your plants.
The reason I ask about flowers is, it was a couple of years ago, maybe three, I'm not sure. I bought some impatiens that I was using for hanging baskets and potted things, you know, like on the porch and so on, on the patio, and they all died. And I didn't know what I did. And well, it turns out, later that summer, I found out that there was some sort of an infestation or disease that affected almost all the impatiens plants.
Yeah.
All over western Pennsylvania. And I blamed myself. And I was.
So you could have let yourself off the hook.
Turns out there was nothing I could have done. So, you know, if you have a problem with this, any sort of a plant, you can get it tested. The Penn State Extension Office, by the way, you're still in the Sunnyview Complex.
That's correct. Yep. Butler. Yep.
So you just take it up there?
Yep, bring it to us. We'll pack it up. We also do insect ID. So we have a master gardener network that is fantastic. We do a lot of insect IDs, a lot of plant IDs and stuff there, where they bring them in. People bring stuff off. I have identified a few snakes. I'd prefer to not. That's not my favorite thing to get in a bag there to identify. But, you know, we can ID snakes. You know, we just like to help, right? You know, we have a great staff up there. I can't thank them enough for the work that they do. But we really like to just know what people want from us, right? I mean, we're kind of here to serve you guys and work for you. But the disease clinic is a fantastic opportunity. The insects with the master gardeners. But if we can't figure it out, then we can send it to the entomology lab. With all of the diseases and the issues with ticks, we now have a tick identification department. If anyone's concerned with Lyme disease, we have a vector-borne disease department, and we can send ticks out there for their identification if you have concerns about that.
Is that free, too, just like the plant identification?
So we can send that through. So the identification part is free. We used to charge for the mailing, but we've actually just cut that out, too, because it's, you know, it's really cheap to mail a tick, right? You know, 50 cents in an envelope. It just seemed kind of...
Yeah, they don't weigh very much.
Yeah, so. Right. It's not like the post office charges much for that. And so, you know, it is. So what they can't do is determine if the tick is infected with Lyme disease, right? So what they're going to do is tell you whether it's a black-legged tick or whether it's a dog tick.
Mm-hmm.
That is just going to be an identification lab. There are other labs that can tell you if that tick is infected with Lyme disease, but at least you would know what kind of tick it is. But again, likely our master gardeners could identify that for you in the office with their microscope in a book.
I have not seen as many stink bugs the last year or so. As remember a couple of years ago, they were everywhere. People would call up and say, the whole side of my house is covered with these things. I don't know whether there just aren't as many, or I haven't been seeing them, or there's some natural predator, please, that's wiping them out. I'm not sure. Have you noticed a decrease in the number of complaints about stink bugs?
Yeah, so brown stink bugs are one of our predators of an economic concern that I monitor.
Yeah, for folks who are not in farmers, this is just, you know, they're just kind of ugly things. They don't bite you. It's no big deal. But they can do serious harm to crops, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, it's this kind of theory of population boom, right? Of a couple years ago, where my house is very close to a soybean field, and we would come home, and the whole side of the house would be covered, and you'd almost be afraid to go inside the door because you didn't want to let them all in there. But again, we haven't had these really hard winters. And so, again, and Japanese beetles have been higher.
Uh-huh.
And again, so you're talking about something that lays an egg. In Japanese beetles, they become a white grub that then burrows and stays in the grass and underneath the ground. And when we don't have these really deep freezing winters, we're not seeing something kill the larvae. Now, last year, we had a different winter. Last year, we had some pretty cold days, and we stayed down. I think I had negative 13 a couple times at the house.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw a much different pattern with our insects
because
we had a deeper freeze. The previous year to that wasn't quite as cold. And so, again, and we see an increased population, and then we start to see things like parasitic wasps, some spiders and things that then will also boom to control the larvae.
Take a quick break. We have a little bit more time to chat with Justin Brackenridge, Penn State Extension Agronomy Educator. We'll be back right after this message. The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. Welcome back. We're chatting with Penn State Extension agronomy educator Justin Brackenridge. He was telling me during the break that as ugly as stink bugs are at their adult stage, and they are grotesque, they are really, really ugly. You say when they're at the nymph stage, yeah, they're quite beautiful?
Yeah, so there's two kinds, right, that we really see a lot of in Pennsylvania. There's the brown and there's the green. And the green is a nymph, is black with these really kind of really beautiful neon stripes on it. It's about the size of your thumbnail. So again, you know, I look at things as the scientific. You've pointed that out many times today as our conversation has gone on. I have a much different viewpoint on things than the other person.
You must admit, though, even from a scientific view, stink bugs are ugly.
Yeah, well, you know, it's all in the eye of the beholder and what you're out there looking for. You know, you never know what you're going to stumble across in some of these ecosystems.
One of the other things that you're concerned about from a scientific agronomy standpoint is soil health, and you're going to be talking about that at a conference coming up.
Yeah, so I do want to talk a little bit about that. So February 27th, USDA, the NRCS office here in Butler, they'll be doing their Western Soil Health Conference, and this is a yearly thing that they do. It's really well supported in the community. But they're also working with the No-Till Alliance now and Penn State so that we can kind of get better speakers. We've had good speakers in the past, not knocking any of our speakers because I've been one of them. But, you know, we're looking to draw in people, get some interest outside of our community, reach out, and really try and embrace this, right? So we know there's a lot of people buying for folks' time. And we want to be the ones to come out on top when you're starting to make your decisions for meetings. And so we feel that by working through this, and we can talk about cover cropping, we can talk about machinery setup, the biological health about your herd below ground. So when we talk about the fungi and we talk about the microbiology of the bacterial colonies, we really just want to have a well-rounded day there for everybody to come in. This will be out at the atrium, so you'll get a good lunch. And enjoy just some fellowship and some vendors and hopefully learn something.
No-till farming is growing. You don't go back too many years when it was just standard procedure. You plowed the fields,
right,
then you disc them to break up the furrows, and then you planted. No-till is gaining in popularity. Can backyard gardeners use no-till? I mean, I still know gardeners who They get their garden plowed. Sometimes they get their own garden tractor, a Gravely or whatever, yeah. And they're always out there turning it over and chomping it up into little pieces.
Yeah, so I have a very good friend that is here in Butler, and I've worked with her since I've been here, and she's very passionate about no-till and her garden, and we've had many, many phone calls and visits of what we're looking at is no-till her garden and no-till gardening. And so it's very possible. You know, it's very enjoyable. And, you know, it's all what you want, right? You know, people find so what Marion and I have looked at are we're putting in gardens, and we're almost using it as almost a raised bed system inside her garden, and using where we're building this organic matter, the decomposition of the cover crops that we're putting mm-hmm. down to raise the beds and create furrows to run water off on the sides. It's a really neat little project that we're working on to create a more sustainable system and increase the bug populations and the earthworms without using pesticides or herbicides or any of those kind of things in a home garden.
And of course, on a large-scale farming situation, you're eliminating a great deal of erosion.
Absolutely.
If you use no-till, you keep the good fertile soil on your fields instead of having it run off into the nearby creek or the stream or whatever. What about we get into the warm weather season, but planting is done. Are you able to do any research in the summer whenever the crops start to grow?
Sure, yeah. And so I guess that would be my last point is, if when we get towards the end of the planting season, right, and the end of these meetings, we're always looking for opportunities of producers that want to kind of take their properties and their production to the next step, right? So we have funding that comes from various sources, but one of our really big producers and providers to us is the Pennsylvania Soybean Board. People that are familiar with that, there's a, but if you're not, there's a soybean checkoff, which for every bushel of soybeans that's sold in the state, 0.5 cents is given to the Soybean Board. So for every 2 bushels, 1 penny is given to the Soybean Board. And they use that money for marketing, research, advertising, developing infrastructure. And so we get money through grants to do research. And some of the stuff I've done in the county, we've looked at better inoculation. So when we're talking about legumes and fixing nitrogen and things, what practices can we improve? We've looked at high-low trials. And so if you've ever talked to a farmer, they're always going to say, yeah, this field's good, but for some reason this corner does better than that corner, or this part's better than that part. But why is that? Mm-hmm. So there's all these inherent properties, but beyond that, what causes that? And so that's what we're really studying. We've got a lot of other opportunities. There's sentinel plots where I come out and just scout stuff, and we can spend time looking at diseases and insects together to help educate you, or you're part of a network where we kind of share that information with all producers. I just like to work with new people, right? I don't feel like I've met enough folks. So if you think you would have any interest in research, meeting with me or me coming out to your place and looking at stuff with you, I would really appreciate a phone call or a visit. That would be fantastic.
Is soybean production growing here locally in Butler County and surrounding areas? I can remember when I never forget this. I know exactly where it was. We were on our way to a camping trip in Cook Forest, and we were up around Shippenville up there in Clarion, and past field after field, I didn't know what it was. It was soybeans.
Yeah.
And this is many, 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 many years ago. I mean, it's easy to recognize, even from a passing car, corn mm-hmm. or some other crops, but I had no idea what this was, soybeans. And now I see them all around, everywhere. When you get outside of the city of Butler and you pass soybean fields all the time, it seems that it's a growing crop.
I work with a lot of producers now that can still remember when they would say that you couldn't grow soybeans in western Pennsylvania, that it would be too cold and the ground wasn't right. I would say statistically looking from information because farmland is decreasing, right? So when you would look at it that way, I would say that it is going down. But when you look at the amount of farms that are looking at soybeans, we are getting really, really involved in rotating our crops, right? So that we're not creating these monocultures or doing corn year after year after year. And so I think from that standpoint, yes, because we are looking at that again. So not to sound like a broken record on diseases, but that's a great way to break some disease cycles and some insect cycles, is not doing corn on corn on corn on corn. Because essentially, corn is its purest form, it's a grass. And so when we use corn and then wheat and then sod or grass, you have three grasses. And so those diseases are going to be all very similar, and those insects are all going to be very similar. Mm-hmm. And so we have to get things in there that are not grasses, like an alfalfa that's going to be this broadleaf crop, or a soybean that's a broadleaf. And so we have to diversify the crops that we're using is a way to break these trends. And so that's why I think soybean has some popularity and is trending upward, and also the availability and maturities that we see now.
You make the scientific approach to this easy to understand for us lay people.
I try.
Justin, yeah. Nice to see you again.
Thanks for stopping by.
Me. Yeah. Justin Brackenridge is a Penn State Extension agronomy educator, and he's based here in Butler, although you cover several counties.
I do, yep.
He's based here at the Butler County Penn State Extension office. Hey, there's more to come on It's Your Turn. We have to take a break, and we're going to be talking about, this will be interesting. Our next guest will join us by telephone, Jim Miller. He's the author of a syndicated newspaper column called The Savvy Senior. And in particular, we're going to be talking, coming up on the next segment, about the talk of a lifetime. On tomorrow's program, Ask the Lawyer, with local attorney Sean Gallagher tomorrow. But stick around. We'll chat with Jim Miller coming up here on It's Your Turn in just a couple of moments. Be right back.
Heading out of town for that special Valentine's Day getaway? Be sure to stop by Tobacco for Less for all your smoking and vaping needs. They're Western PA's largest glass emporium, complete with hundreds of glass pipes to choose from. They also feature a walk-in humidor and a 19-foot vape juice bar. Even their health and wellness department stays fully stocked with a great selection of high-quality CBD products. For all your smoking and vaping needs, check out Tobacco for Less, with locations in Butler, Sharon, and Aliquippa.
Hi, this is Dave Malarkey. I'd like to talk to you for just a moment here about the good folks at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here at Butler. What a great job they do to help those who are less fortunate in many ways. They operate the St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank, of course. They have their St. Vincent de Paul Thrift Store in the Greater Butler Mart and their Client Aid Program. And the Client Aid Program helps needy families or individuals, maybe with help on a heating bill or a rent payment at the end of the month, Client Aid. And that's funded through the operation of the thrift store. So you can help by donating items that you no longer need or want to the thrift store. It's very easy to do. Drop-off bins are right inside the door. You can use the container outside. They're located in the Greater Butler Mart. So think about it. Next time you're cleaning the closet or the upstairs, instead of throwing that stuff away, why not donate it to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler? We stand tallest when we stoop to help others. Very important subject, listeners, to discuss here on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. Welcome. My name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest chatting with us by telephone is Jim Miller. He is the creator and the editor of Savvy Senior, a weekly question and answer column for seniors and those who support them. Jim Miller, nice to meet you. Great to have you with us here today.
Yeah, Dave, thanks for having me on your program.
There's a campaign that's underway across the country, and it's interesting. It's called Have the Talk of a Lifetime. Have the Talk of a Lifetime. Jim Miller, what's this all about?
Well, it's kind of a twofold project. The first part of it is about helping families connect a little bit better. It's about having meaningful conversations about what matters to them most and what they hope to pass on to future generations, things like that. And the second part is really about helping families have important end-of-life conversations about how they want to be remembered and how they want things handled after they're gone. Because The reason behind this is because families don't have, you know, these types of conversations because they're awkward or uncomfortable or they don't think about it. So the campaign is all about talking and communicating with your older loved one and connecting and then being able to have these important conversations that we all need to have.
Mm-hmm. And families, quite frankly, given American lifestyle these days, families aren't together as much as they used to be whenever it was very common for families to live in the same town or even the same neighborhood. Now different parts of the country, and you might only be getting together a couple of times a year on major holidays, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And that's a great time to be able to have these conversations. You know, you can do it via video phone as well, but those personal times of family get-togethers or reunions or whatever, it's a great time to be able to sit down as a family and talk about things like this.
Well, let's talk about this because, let's face it, many adult children don't know a lot of details about their elderly parents' end-of-life plans. And this is important to know. You mentioned, Jim, it's not the easiest thing to bring up sometimes, but you need to do it, don't you?
You do. And it's important for from one standpoint because it helps you avoid problems. Because a lot of families, by having these conversations, you can prepare, you can learn about how people are prepared. For example, legal documents. We all need, you know, like a will, a power of attorney, advanced directive, documents like that. So having these conversations can help either prompt you to make the documents even if you don't have them or update them if you do have them, because that's always important to do as well. It also helps families organize important financial information that can help their adult children, you know, execute their long-term care and estate plans. Because if you don't have this information, a lot of kids don't even know how much money their parents have or they don't know where it is. And all of these create a real messy situation at end of life. If you don't have these conversations, you don't know this information. So as an adult child, it really provides some incentive to really take action on this because it helps avoid a real messy, problematic situation at end of life. And it also helps seniors, gives them some peace of mind to know that their affairs are in order as well.
Yeah. For this campaign, Jim Miller, you've teamed up with the Funeral and Memorial Information Council, FAMIC. I must confess that's an organization I had not heard of before. Have you worked with them previously, Jim?
No, I never have, yeah. They have an acronym they use, FAMIC, if you'd rather. Because the Funeral and Memorial Information Council is a mouthful. But yeah, they represent the funeral industry and about planning ahead. And planning ahead is just a good thing. It's with anything that we do, if you give a little thought and plan ahead, you're always a little bit better off for it.
Well, this organization, FAMIC, has actually come up with an idea to help break the ice a little bit for these conversations. They have cards, I guess, right?
Yeah, they do. They're pretty cool. They're conversation cards, and they're like a deck of cards. And there's 50 in a deck, and they have questions on them. Some of them are more serious, some of them are lighthearted, but they're cards that you play as a family where you deal out a card to each person and they ask you questions about your life. You know, who's most influential to you, you know, some just things that can help you open up and learn about your loved one that you may not know about otherwise. So it's a fun way to kind of push families in the direction of, you know, connecting and learning about things that are important to them. So it's a great icebreaker, and it's really fun for those holidays or for weekends that you're together. And it helps younger generations, grandkids, connect with their grandparents better because grandkids in today's world are always on their cell phones all the time, consistently. So this helps you to put the phone down and pick up the cards, and it's a fun way to be able to connect and get to know about your grandparents in a way that you may not even know about at all.
You could do this one-on-one. I would suggest, though, probably the most comfortable way would be to gather members of the family around, the kitchen table or something like that and have everybody take part. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to do it. And some of the cards, the questions on there will be like, how do you want to be remembered? What's the best lesson you learned from your mom or dad or other role model? You know, what personal events have shaped your life most? What's been the most influential person in your life? What's the scariest thing that ever happened to you? So just a wide variety of stuff that everybody can participate in. And you just get to know each other in a little bit more deeper, meaningful way.
It's so important to to talk about these things while there are still people around who remember. I know I was in conversation actually just a few weeks ago, Jim, with one of my siblings, and the question came up just as a matter of course, in what cemetery is one of our relatives buried? And I didn't know, and my sibling didn't know either, and then we suddenly were rueing the fact that probably everybody who does know has now died, and you know we needed this information years ago.
Yeah. You need it. That creates some urgency to it too, because you know not everybody's going to be around forever, so you need to take the opportunity now while you have the time to be able to talk to your loved ones. And it's interesting. There's the Ancestry.com has done some different surveys on this, and they found that you know grandkids do not have a very good understanding in today's world about their grandparents. A lot of them don't even know how their grandparents met, and a big percentage of them didn't even know what their grandparents did for a living. So, I mean, it's just we've kind of become such a technology-focused world, we kind of lose a lot of, you know, meaningful connection and family stories. And that's what the campaign is about. It's about connecting, and then some of the resources that we have on the website and the conversation cards help families connect in a more meaningful way and then have those important conversations about end of life.
So there's a website for this too, Jim Miller?
Yeah, there is. It's called talkofalifetime.org. It's all together, talkofalifetime.org, where you can go and you can get your conversation cards and you can get all kinds of resources about how to connect and have family conversations. And I'll tell you another popular thing too, Dave, is a lot of families today some make videos of their elder loved ones where they talk about things that are meaningful to them and things that their greatest accomplishments, their greatest regrets, and they make little video films of their loved ones so they can share it with their children and grandchildren. It's a great gift to be able to give yourself and your family and to be able to capture it from your older loved ones. And the Talk of a Lifetime is a great resource to give you all kinds of questions to help you set up interviews and talk to your aging loved ones and put together like a little video or audio recording. It's a wonderful gift for family members to get to each other.
Much, much easier to do today. If you go back even 10, 15 years, you needed one of those expensive video cameras. Today you can do it with your phone, you know.
That's exactly right. I mean, take that technology that I've been complaining about so much and put it to some good use, and it doesn't take you, I mean, you can do the video for free on your phone, for sure.
We have a few more minutes, listeners, to chat with Jim Miller about having the talk of a lifetime and how to do it, how to get started. We'll take a quick break, pick up our conversation with Jim here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
Do you have missing teeth or wear dentures? You may have heard of or are considering dental implants. Hi, this is Dr. Bob Todd of Butler Smiles Dental Care. There are many options available with dental implants, and making the right choice can be confusing. I have been placing dental implants since 2004, both full-size traditional implants and small diameter or mini dental implants. There are indications for both, but more and more we are using mini dental implants in a variety of innovative ways. They are easier to place, causing less discomfort, are less costly, and can frequently be used immediately after placement, allowing you to get back to eating the foods you like or smiling again right away. Traditional implants typically have a 4-month healing time before they can be used. I invite you to call our office at 282-7774 to schedule a free consultation to see if mini dental implants are the right solution for your dental problems, or visit us on the web at butlersmiles.com.
Are you 65 years of age? Did you know you are eligible to ride free transportation? That's right, free transportation. Sign up for your free transit pass at Butler Transit Authority's downtown bus terminal on West Newcastle Street. Ride the local Butler buses to shopping, destinations, medical appointments, and more. Feeling more adventurous? Take the bus to Pittsburgh. Shop, dine, and explore all that Pittsburgh has to offer. Visit our bus terminal or butlertransit.com for more information.
Welcome back. I'm Dave Malarkey. Our guest on this segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR is Jim Miller, and we're talking about having the talk of a lifetime with older family members. Jim Miller, in case you're joining us a little bit late, is the creator and the editor of Savvy Senior. That's a weekly question and answer column for seniors and those who support them. You're in quite a few newspapers with your column, Jim, I guess, right?
Yeah, it runs in over 300 papers across the country.
Ooh, wow.
It's got a readership of about 4.5 million people, so yeah.
How did you get this column started? Did something happen in your life, or what led you to do this?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I've been doing it for 17 years now, and I started off, I was caregiving for my mom. She had breast cancer, and my dad was, you know, real involved with her care as well, and they both passed away at the same time. My dad had a heart attack, and my mom ended up succumbing to breast cancer, and so after I lost them, I was, you know, quite distraught. I was completely unexpected to lose my dad. So I started doing some volunteer work at a retirement community to kind of help me get through the grieving process. And when I was there, I started a little column to help promote the retirement community. And that's kind of when I kind of stumbled upon the need for information for seniors because, you know, seniors, there's so much out there and there's a lot of programs and resources available to them that they don't know about. There's a lot of scams. There's a lot of, you know, there's just a lot of bad stuff that's out there, but there's a lot of good stuff. So how do they find it? And I kind of started it as a conduit to kind of help people just, you know, get information that could help improve their life and their quality of life. And that's how it started. And I messed around with it for about a year and kind of, you know, learned about things. And then I got the idea that I could share this with other papers. So I came up with the name Savvy Senior, and I started marketing it around the country. And that was back in 2002. And it went from the one paper, which was the local paper here in Norman, Oklahoma, to be in about 400 papers. That's kind of how it got going. And then I got some national press. The New York Times did a story on me, and I got on the Today Show. I was on the Today Show like 35, been on the Today Show like 35 times. And so, that's kind of how it started, though.
Well, this is something that I just feel there are so many people out there, so many families who have thought about doing this, who want to do this, but for one reason or another, you know, they've just never done it. And then all of a sudden they find that it's too late and the people that they needed to talk to have died and you can't do it. If you're worried about how to start this conversation, because as Jim Miller said earlier, it can be a little awkward sometimes. Although my guess is, Jim, honestly, once you get going, most elderly relatives, whether it's parents, grandparents, whatever, they're probably pretty anxious to tell their story once you get started on the process, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of it is just kind of taking that first step. And, you know, people, if you're uncomfortable or it seems awkward to do that, then use this radio show as your prompt. Say, hey, you know, I was listening to a radio show and they were talking about this, and I think this would be something great for us to talk about, you know, to your mom or your dad. So use this as a prompter to kind of help move your way into it. And then the talkofalifetime.org website has all kinds of conversation starters that are great for people as well. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think that there's, you know, certain families, like my dad was not very open. So I understand the challenges of it for some families because my dad was a World War II veteran. And, you know, a lot of older people in today's world were Vietnam vets and they might not have the ability to open up or have these intimate conversations. But there's ways that you can kind of penetrate that with some of these techniques that talkofalifetime.org offers to kind of help you, you know, get into your loved one's heart through the back door if you need to do that. So lots of tools that are out there.
And sometimes you can start with something easy. If you feel you have an older relative who's hesitant to talk about things that are too personal to start off with. Somebody asked me last year, it was just an innocent question. It was actually one of my sisters. Asked me, what's the first movie you can ever remember seeing? And it took me back for a second. I had to stop and think. And then I remembered what it was, and that led to an interesting conversation for several minutes. You can start with something like that. And there are more ideas like this on this deck of cards that you can get, right?
Yeah, there's lots of ways. You don't jump right into something that's real heavy. You kind of, it's like any conversation, you start off with something a little lighter, like you're talking about, your favorite movie, your favorite music, you know, just memories, photo albums. Looking at photo albums or old memorabilia are great ways to stir memories. Or just, you know, what was it like for you back, you know, when you were, you know, 25 years old and first getting started, or when you first got married, or all those things. People want to be understood, and no matter how old, and it's just I think it's, the campaign is just about reconnecting, and I think it's so important in today's technology world where people are so disconnected. It really becomes very important to do that, especially among young people and the old people. I mean, grandkids and grandparents. There's so many great ways to be able to connect, and we just need to take the incentive to do that.
I never thought about the photo album. That's a fabulous idea. Get out an old photo album, set it out in the middle of the kitchen table, and everybody gather around. And you know, if that isn't a conversation starter, then you got problems.
yeah, that's right. Because, you know, those photos will stir all kinds of memories and bring up all conversations and things that you might not even know about. You know, it's interesting. A quick story here. When my dad passed away, I mean, I love my dad, but we didn't talk about it. We weren't super intimate because dad was difficult to do that. But when he passed away, I was after his funeral, I was talking to some of his friends that he went to high school with, some guys that I knew of but I didn't really know, and they were telling me stories about my dad that just, like, no way. They were telling me stories about things that he did when he was, like, in high school or when he was in his early 20s, and I just found it to be quite interesting and funny because these are stories that I never knew about him. Because when I was, my dad was 40 years old when I was born, and so I only knew my dad as a middle-aged and an older man. I didn't know him as a young person. And so when I was hearing these stories, I found it to be quite, you know, enlightening and very heartwarming, and just kind of funny, because dad did a lot of, you know, silly kid things like we all do. But when you hear about it from your father, it kind of, like, wow. And it's just kind of, it always kind of, you know, it makes me smile when I think about that. But that's why I think this is so important, because this gives you the ability to be able to really get to know a loved one in a different kind of way while they're still alive, which is so important.
Yeah. I know. I came across, actually, it was a family member, a great aunt, who gave me a picture of my dad when he was, I would guess, 8 years old. He was a paper boy delivering the Pittsburgh Sun-Telegraph paper. And there he is with his, you know, the newspaper bag, you know, like the carriers have over their shoulder, wearing shorts. Just absolutely priceless, priceless.
Yeah,
a couple of more questions, Jim, here before our time totally runs out. Think about this, listeners. Most folks, I think, at least know their grandparents' names, even if they're not alive anymore. Do you know the names of your great-grandparents? I'll bet a lot of people don't. If your grandparents have passed away, or even if your parents have died, don't give up on this. I mean, you can talk to aunts, uncles, right, cousins who might have that information, Jim?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when you're, you know, at family reunions or other family members that you connect with, whether it's online or Facebook or video calls or whatever, yeah, you can find out all kinds of family stuff by talking. And there's probably people in your family that maybe have done family trees and maybe do some ancestry work as well. So there's lots of ways to be able to find out about past relatives and stuff that can enrich your life.
Now, from a practical side, of course, there are legal documents that we would want to know about for aging relatives. You know, do you have a will? Where is it? That sort of thing.
Yeah.
Financial records. You know, do you have insurance policies? Which companies? Where are they? So on and so forth. And then also something that this is really awkward, Jim, for many folks, many families, funeral plans. We have to talk about those in advance too, do we not?
It's definitely a good idea to make those preparations ahead of time, because, you know, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, number one, it alleviates the adult children's time it helps them so they don't have to make it at a stressful, difficult time, and it helps, you know, the loved one or the older person determine how they want to be remembered. So it gives you a voice. It saves family grief at a difficult time, And it also is a way to be able to save money, too, because you can plan appropriately, you can make decisions, you know, sound financial decisions, and it's just a win-win all across the board to be able to make these preparations ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So this is all part of it, you know, the end-of-life conversations, the knowing about preparing legally, having the legal documents in place and updated, knowing about the financial resources, where they are, how you want those executed, and also to the end-of-life plans, the funeral planning. It all is a package that's very, very important to do. It provides great peace of mind, and it really does help things go much, much smoother at the very end of life.
Peace of mind for the older folks, too. I mean, you know, do you want a big formal religious funeral? You want something simple? What music do you want to be played? And I guess there's help, too, on the website, Jim Miller, for these sorts of questions, a detailed list of funeral and memorial planning questions available on the website, right?
Yeah, there is. It's a funeral preparation checklist that you can go through. It has all those questions, like you talked about. You know, do you want a religious, you want a formal, you want to be cremated, you want to be buried, all of those questions that can kind of help you sort through things that can help you make sense. You know, a lot of people, they might want to have these conversations, but they don't know what to ask. They don't know what to plan for. The talkofalifetime.org has all that for you. It's laid out in a simple format that can help you, get the questions and the information that you need. It just lays it all out for you, so it makes it easy to do.
Pretty good stuff, folks. Put together a teamwork, actually, with the Jim Miller, our guest, and the Funeral and Memorial Information Council, FAMIC. They have these cards, this deck of cards, to help you get started on these conversations, and also information on the website as well. Talkofalifetime.org is the web address, and as usual, that's all smooshed together. Talkofalifetime.org. Jim Miller, partnering with FAMIC, visiting with us. Jim, it was nice to meet you. This is important stuff, and all of your tips will make it much easier, I think, to get these conversations started. Thanks much.
I hope so. Thank you, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Sure, sure. And we'll look for your column, too, The Savvy Senior, syndicated in more than 400 newspapers around the country, Jim Miller. All right, thanks again.
So long. You bet. Thank you.